This is Anya Leonard, the co-founder of Classical Wisdom, a website dedicated to bringing ancient wisdom to modern minds. I'm talking today with Aaron Smith, fellow at the Ayn Rand Institute. Thank you, Aaron, for joining me today.
Happy to be here.
Now, we published an article of yours about a week or so ago called The False Promise of Stoicism, and it garnered quite a bit of attention and discussion, which I'm always happy to get people talking with whatever regard. And quite a few people asked why somebody was writing from the Ayn Rand Institute on classical wisdom. And I thought, you know, fair enough, it's a good question. Of course, you're involved in philosophy. But I hadn't actually realized fully before starting to talk with you just how influenced Ayn Rand was by the ancient philosophers, and in particular, Aristotle. So maybe to start off, you can give us a quick background on the relationship between Ayn Rand and Aristotle, and maybe just also a 2-second clip, just in case people don't know who Ayn Rand is, because I know a lot of our followers are, you know, about a couple thousand years earlier than her, so.
She's dead, but not that dead.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, sure. So, hi everyone. I'm speaking to an audience that's new to me, so I'm hope you find this interesting. So Ayn Rand was a 20th century philosopher born in Russia. Left Russia when she Soviet Union at the time when she was 21. Built a career here as a novelist. She wrote the Fountainhead and Atlas Shrugged, her most famous novels. And then after the publication of Atlas Shrugged in 1957, she turned to writing nonfiction works in philosophy, lots of essays, philosophical essays, to elaborate on what her philosophic perspective was. She's super controversial. So people, it's often said they love her or hate her.
Or sometimes they love her and then hate her. You know?
Yeah, no, and that's a phenomenon. They become very attracted to the idealism, I think, the immoral idealism of her philosophy, and then they come to think it's not practical for some reason, or then you grow up, as you often hear it, but it's, in various reasons, people can come to abandon it or embrace it if they think it's true. She was a well-known public intellectual in the 50s, 60s, 70s. I mean, she's on talk shows, she's on Johnny Carson, she's on radio programs, TV programs, university campuses. She gave a whole range of talks at the Ford Hall Forum in Boston. So she's very, very well known, but super controversial because she's challenging fundamental aspects of our moral framework. And that's a hard thing to do.
And she's so iconic. I mean, you just think of the videos of her darting her eyes and speaking so furiously and passionately. I mean, you've got to love the energy that she brings to just her sheer mind and brain power.
Yeah.
If you're going to come up with something new, you know, you might not be getting everything right all the time, but it's pretty remarkable, some of her.
And I think what you're talking about is that she takes ideas seriously. Like, philosophy is not a game. It's not a pastime. It's about the true and the good. And if you care about what's true and you care about what's good, you're passionate about ideas, and you fight for them. And she was a fighter in that regard. If one's interested in those kind of ideas, I mean, you'd have to explore and, you know, see what you think about them. But to the point about Aristotle, so she had an enormous respect for Aristotle. And she regarded him, I think, as preeminently, well, I guess she can be the second Dante, to regard him as the philosopher. You know, she regarded him as, what was the phrase from Dante? The master of them that know. She regarded him as, to use her terminology, the Atlas that's carrying Western civilization on his back. And to get why she has such an enormous respect for Aristotle, I think of Ayn Rand as a genius, and I think of Aristotle absolutely as a genius. She wouldn't have put herself on Aristotle's level, but I think it's one genius's perspective on another, and that her respect for Aristotle comes, I think, mostly from his his achievements in epistemology about the method of knowledge. And I think what Aristotle really stands for is the efficacy of the human mind. And Ayn Rand said that the fundamental issue in philosophy is the cognitive efficacy of man's mind. Is the mind capable and able to know the world, to understand it, to organize human existence in a way that you can live a successful life, a good life, a happy life? And Aristotle's view is yes. And Ayn Rand's view is yes. If you follow reason and the method of reason, which is logic. And in that regard, she isolated, I think, what she took as the most important thing of Aristotle's contribution, and that was the identification of the laws of logic. It's not that no one was rational until before Aristotle, but what Aristotle did by identifying the laws of logic, and particularly the axioms of logic, the principle of non-contradiction and so on, which give you the basic norms for thinking. Like, if you violate the principle of non-contradiction, you've gone off the rails somewhere in your thinking. Because these are principles of what he called being qua being. These are things, entities in the world have a non-contradictory identity. They are what they are. They can't be both A and not A at the same time and in the same respect. And if there's any of that going on in your thinking, you've gone off the rails. You're not talking about reality anymore. You're getting it wrong. And so it gave people, I think, more self-conscious control over how to be logical and how to use reason to arrive at the truth. And she took it to be an enormous achievement, an enormous abstraction. So to get that, there's a method of reason as such. So your own cognitive tool to get the world, it has a method. And it doesn't matter whether you're thinking about employee compensation, or you're thinking about what car to buy, or you're thinking about mathematics, or you're thinking about zoology. This is the method one uses. And to abstract away from all the disciplines, like what principles they use, what facts they're observing, and to abstract from that and say there's a method of cognition as such, and then to isolate its fundamental principles, it's a titanic achievement, I think. And I mean, what Aristotle represents to Rand, I mean, he's the preeminent exponent of the efficacy of reason and of this world. And it's man's life on this world and his individual happiness that is the goal of ethics. And I mean, there's a ton you can say about Aristotle's achievement, but Rand, because there's a parallels between objectivism, which is what Ayn Rand called her own philosophy, and Aristotle. I mean, both are secular worldviews. There's nature, that's it. There's no afterlife, there's no mystical soul, there's no appeal to faith in Aristotle. And similarly with objectivism, her view is that reason is an absolute, logic is the method of reason, that there's only this world. It's a very pro-science, pro-reason, pro-man, pro-this world. I mean, you think about Aristotle's conception of what a human being can be like, and you read in, well, first of all, just read Aristotle and think about what kind of a person Aristotle was. But then also read the passage in the Nicomachean Ethics where he talks about the great-souled man. Sometimes it's translated pride. It's the magnificent portrait of the proud man or the great-souled man. And you get a sense of what man can be like. And I think that kind of idealism about what man is capable of, man is a heroic being, that's very much Ayn Rand. So objectivism is, I think, a major development within the Aristotelian tradition. I mean, I think that's a way to capture what the relationship is.
You know, it's interesting because I hadn't realized until starting to speak with you that so many eminent philosophers in the field of Aristotle, you know, got there through Ayn Rand and vice versa. You know, people get to Aristotle from Rand. And I think also what you're saying, though, about her really finding what Aristotle did as significant, the underlying point of that is in a way that the people before him were not achieving those same successes. And, you know, for instance, I've heard her just sort of blast into the pre-Socratics, you know, horrifically. And I have a few questions, but I should say that they come from her 1963 review of John Herman Randall's book, Aristotle. which if you haven't, I mean, you sent it to me, but for our listeners, if you haven't listened to it, it's a pretty fantastic interview, review spoken by Rand herself. But in there, she sort of characterized the duel between Plato and Aristotle as sort of a relation, a difference between mysticism and reason. So do you think that's fair? I mean, yes, Aristotle proves reason, fair enough, but do you think Plato is just a mystic?
So you've probably heard it said, it's a common thing that's been said, is that everyone is fundamentally either an Aristotelian or a Platonist. And of course, it's not literally true, but there's a respect in which it is true that there's a the level of fundamentals. There's a real bifurcation between an Aristotelian worldview and a Platonist worldview. You asked about reason versus mysticism. So yes, Aristotle is a champion of reason, and it's a this-worldly faculty. So reason is a natural, fully natural, biological faculty of certain living organisms at a certain level of complexity. It's not the body's a tomb and the soul comes from another world and temporarily housed in the body. The body's part of this messy, muddy, semi-real world full of contradictions. But the soul's true home is in another dimension, right? That's Plato. I mean, that's being a little flippant with Plato. I mean, Plato's a brilliant genius. I love teaching Plato. Ayn Rand couldn't stand reading Plato because when she looks at the level of fundamentals, she thinks it's a terrible system. And it certainly has been, Plato's views have certainly been in the basis for most totalitarian thought, because it takes you from the basic metaphysics of it, that individuals aren't fully real, that somehow the collective is what's real, and the individuals can't, the citizenry can't really, they're too stupid or too irrational to know what to do, and they have to be governed by an elite. There's a whole, I mean, you read the Plato's Republic, it's a blueprint.
Tyranny.
Yeah, absolutely, and it was taught for that purpose. So back to the mysticism and reason. The reason why she thinks of Plato as mysticism is, like, Plato, he talks about the three parts of the soul, and he thinks reason should be guiding you. So you've got your appetites for, you know, food, money, and sex. I don't know why money gets thrown in there all the time, but whatever. It's your appetites. And some people are led by their appetites. And then there's your more spirited emotions like indignation and anger and so on. But then reason really needs to be what guides you, because that's the way in which you come to determine what's best for you and what's true and stuff. So there's a respect in which he has a respect for reason. But Rand's views, it fundamentally boils down to mysticism, because what is reason for Plato? It's your means of accessing what's really true and good and important in some other dimension somehow. So he recognizes the importance of the conceptual level of thought, you know, where you're dealing with abstractions. Well, what I would call abstractions, you can think of them as universals or forms or whatever, but it's, you're thinking of the level of the justice, the good, truth, knowledge. Those are the important things. That's a really important level of thinking to be able to operate on. But his view ultimately was, to get that, you need to go to another world. Like, you can't get it from this world. It's not like these things are ways of abstracting or capturing aspects of the world so that you can come to understand them. It's, you got to get the hell out of this world.
It's literally otherworldly.
It's otherworldly. And he talks about, you know, the soul, and, you know, these are all metaphors and stuff, but there's a sense in which it's just, this is how he thinks about it. And to give Plato, to be objective about Plato, I mean, Plato says, well, I wouldn't exactly say that this is exactly true, but there's some kind of way in which it is. So he doesn't really know quite how to think about it. But in every time he tries to capture it, it's the soul has to escape the tomb of the body in this world and go to another dimension. And it just, I don't know, sees them or whatever. And so it's not clear. So, I mean, you know, Ayn Rand considers that mysticism. And I think it's right. So if reason is a matter of, I get truths from God, well, you've sort of gutted what reason is, and now it's just revelation. Not that he's saying, that's not Plato's view, but.
Of course, it's interesting because at different time periods, Aristotle is more popular, or Plato is more popular, or, you know, the pre-Socratics come back and into fashion. So in Rand's same review, she also wrote that Aristotle may be regarded as the cultural barometer of Western history. So what did she really mean by that? I mean, are we really only doing well if Aristotle's in fashion?
Yeah, that kind of interpretation, it's a bit too, it's not abstract enough. So it's, her view is that what it means for a period or an era to be dominated by Aristotelian influence doesn't mean they accept the four causes or things like that. It's more that it's dominated by his philosophic fundamentals. It's the centrality and the efficacy of reason in all aspects of life. And the focus on, and that it's this worldly. So this is a secular, this worldly, pro-man, pro-reason culture. And its focus in ethics is on achieving individual happiness. If those are the philosophic fundamentals that are the mainstream or at least dominant among the dominant intellectuals in a culture, you're going to get a much better culture than a culture dominated by your inherently evil, stained with sin. This world is a transient period that we have to escape from. It's a veil of tears. You have to weep and repent, obey authority, and to get to another dimension where you can get out of this hell. Now, if that's your perspective, taking the religious sort of the kind of Middle Ages kind of perspective, you're going to get a life of, I mean, what Ayn Rand puts it is, it's faith and force are corollaries. If you have a period dominated by faith, and what you expect of them is faith, what you expect is obedience. And in that sense, what you do is you shut down the mind, you shut down real thinking, you shut down science, you shut down innovation. And what you want from people is obedience at a cognitive level. And what you get is it also at a political level. Because then what's, you know, and this is what you got in the Middle Ages. It's the Pope has armies at its command, and you get feudal societies, the absolute monarchies.
So I guess one of the...
Anyway, whereas you look at the Enlightenment, it's a very different period.
Yeah, and one of the time periods that I guess Rand would have been a big fan of was the beginnings of the United States of America. So she said again in that same review that that she felt that Aristotle, via John Locke, was actually the philosophical father of the United States Constitution and thus capitalism. Do you think Aristotle was that prominent in the beginnings of America, I suppose?
No, in the sense that they're directly, as if they were directly referring to Aristotle. When Rand thinks in very, like panning way back, again, to the level of philosophic fundamentals, the chain, I think she thinks from Aristotle to John Locke, you know, who's formulating a principle of individual rights and that this is what governments are instituted to protect. I mean, this is what Jefferson is channeling in the Declaration of Independence, you know, that you have a right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And the reason governments are instituted, in other words, the proper moral justification for the institutions of government, is only to protect those rights. Now that, I think, I regard that as an enormous achievement and also a very rare flower in the history of human beings, it's a rare and precious flower that can go away quickly. I think this has to be protected. So this is an enormous value. And Locke is instrumental in that. Now, the respect in which Aristotle is the grandfather, so to speak, of this trend, I think she means this again from the level of, it's the Enlightenment's, there's a reason why Enlightenment, the age of reason. And in that regard, it's an Aristotelian age. In other words, not dominated again, like by the four causes and the natural slave and his theory of art. It's not really at that level of specificity. It's more that it's an age where reason is regarded as your preeminent faculty and your guide to life and living. And that this world and this worldly happiness is what we're after. It's a secular pro-reason, pro-man, pro-this-life, pro-happiness view. And, you know, when you think about somebody like John Locke, it's, I think John Locke is quite secular. He's not an atheist, but he's quite secular in the way he thinks. There's other areas where he's not. But it's about man's life on earth, and about, he puts it as, what does he put it? Not as survival. He puts it as a self-preservation. You know, the focus is on self-preservation. And he says something like, I mean, he brings God into it at certain times where he thinks he needs it, but it's something like, he said something to the effect of, you know, God gave the earth to the rational and the productive. He didn't say productive. He said the industrious, I think it was, but it's about, and so if you look at this from Aristotle's bringing in, it's the Aristotelian influence that brings in the centrality of reason in this world and this life and happiness and life on earth and science. And then you think about the Enlightenment as an age of, these are the ideas that are dominating or coming to dominate. But what the Enlightenment got, and I think you needed this as the bridge, which wasn't in Aristotle, the bridge toward a view of the Declaration of Independence, individual rights, is that what reason fundamentally needs is freedom. So you can say, as Aristotle does, you know, that or it's his view, that reason is your means of knowledge. It's your means of scientific understanding. It's a means of grasping the truth and ordering your life and ordering your political systems. But what they grasped or started to grasp in the Enlightenment, and what reason needs is freedom. Freedom from kings, freedom from the Pope. It's the mind doesn't function by force. The mind doesn't, they didn't quite put it that way, but it's, you think of Galileo. Galileo's mind doesn't work when the church puts him under house arrest. It doesn't work if what the king, if on intellectual issues, the king's view is what counts. And their view is, no, we can be self-governing. If we go by reason, we can be self-governing. And to be self-governing and to go by reason means you need freedom. And you started to get the development of countries more political freedom. And so in that way, so it's taking the grand perspective. And I think that's how she would draw the conclusion.
Now, I think this brings us to the point that I'm sure everybody always thinks when it comes to Aristotle and Rand and Aristotle. But you mentioned the whole issue with the natural slaves. And as much as anybody loves Aristotle, that's always a pretty hard, bitter, very bitter pill to even think about swallowing. So how does Rand square sort of Aristotle's defense of slavery? And that's just to let everyone know that based on the theory that some are congenitally incapable of reasoning and thus natural slaves, and he says, what about those who are superior in goodness and ought to rule over and be the master of his inferiors? So how does Rand get out of that difficulty?
Well, she doesn't get out of it, and she doesn't have to square it. Her view is that it's a terrible view. So she's not one of the types that you've got to defend everything Aristotle stood for. I mean, her view is, no, he got a lot of things wrong. And she's perfectly willing to call him out on anything that he got wrong. But she thinks that he got so much and so fundamental things right that he's a genius and a titan for that, and no matter what his errors. Now, on the issue of slavery, I've got, there's a book here edited by Robert Mayhew called Ayn Rand's Marginalia. So it's, you know, her side marginal notes in her books and stuff, because we at the Ayn Rand Institute, we've got her books, her own personal effects. It's where the Ayn Rand archives are. Just like you'd have a Ernest Hemingway archives or something, we have the Ayn Rand archives, and her stuff is there.
Oh, that must be fantastic.
Yeah, it is fascinating. Letters and everything. So in this Marginalia book, she pointed about her view about slavery. She said it's a shameful view that he would have this sort of view. But there's the passage about people being naturally rulers over others. She said, what was the passage? So I don't mean to take up time, but she said something like, good God, in the margin with exclamation marks. And she said a dreadful quote from A, just the letter A, you know? And so no, she thought that was just a horrible perspective. But his whole view of slavery is interesting though. And there's nothing to really, so when you think about justifying it, you're not saying, And so Ayn Rand doesn't say anything to justify it. She's like, it's terrible, you know, view. But it's interesting when you look at what his view of slavery is. He's talking and flagging the issue that some people think slavery is always wrong. It's always wrong in Greek culture, which is interesting. That's not how you often think of Greek culture. But so in other words, he's talking about there is a trend where people think it's always wrong. And some people think it's always right. You know, no matter if you're caught in war or you're congenitally incompetent, if that's even the case, right? And he says, this is not the right way to think about it. And he thinks sometimes it's justified because, so idea is, if you're incapable of reasoning to the point where you can actually project and think long range and determine what your actions are, then it's appropriate for you to be guided by someone who can think about that. One of the things that that theory does is it starts to undermine slavery, because then the question is, who's like that? And so his view is, and there are many respects in which people are slaves by law, which they should not be. Like, they're captured in war, and the idea is, well, I agree not to kill you, but you can work on my estate, or you're my slave. And he says, but a person who's able to think for themselves and reason about what their life is like, they shouldn't be a slave. So in a way, part of his conception of slavery, I think, started to help to undermine it in various kind of ways. I don't think that was his aim.
Yeah, but, well, also, I mean, I feel like somebody could correct me if I'm wrong on this, but didn't he have slaves that he never freed himself, even though he would have been able to? I mean, he didn't
put so that this in is, so that's a, yeah, that's another interesting thing. We have what we think to be his will, and it's taken to be genuine by scholars. And in that document, he frees almost all of his slaves. And there's I think it's kind of a moving document. I mean, he says there's this.
So a few of them were natural slaves.
What he did was he said he left a few slaves to, I think, one of his daughters. I can't remember the exact details. And he said, but when she comes of age and she gets married to so-and-so, they're to be let free. And he names one of the slaves, and he says, and I don't remember his name, but such and such is to be returned to his people in a manner befitting our family, you know, and with such and such they give him some money and they return the slave. And so it's an interesting, it doesn't justify, I mean, nothing justifies slavery, but I think when you put it more in terms of the context of Aristotle's attitude toward it, which is not, I think, simple, and then his own attitude towards his own slaves, I think it puts him, I think, in a better light, though. I mean, it's an earlier time, too.
Yeah, I mean, it's always a problem we have with regards to looking in history, that we want to project our own ideas and situations. And, you know, just saying, as you were about Rand, believing that you can add on to Aristotle, and I'm glad that you said that, because you know, it's always something I try to say to in at Classical Wisdom on the newsletter and podcasts and such, that I mean, I love discussing these ancient philosophers. I do think they're really important to hold up, but they shouldn't be beyond questioning, because actually society often stalls when we do that, if we don't question while we learn about them. And this was a problem with Hippocrates as well. So I was going to say, one of the interesting things was I had read about Ayn Rand adding, with regards to the definition of happiness, what was it, that you could have productive work and romantic work. And in Aristotle, romantic, you know, love, yeah, romantic love, sorry.
romantic work.
You can love your work, I don't know. But that, you know, Aristotle talks about friendship a lot, and, you know, friendship is beautiful, and the whole Nicomachean Ethics about friendship, it's really a fantastic part. But also that in that historical time period, you couldn't love between a man and woman maybe in the same way that you could today, because there were so few educated women. So men would just struggle to find an equal partner in the way that they could potentially today, you know. And you think of Rand herself as being a very intellectual woman, that coming in as equals between a man and a woman would be something that just wouldn't have existed really as much back in Aristotle's day.
Yeah, I mean, in some sense, I think the the real intellectual conversation people got, men got, who were thinkers, was from courtesans.
Yeah.
They weren't under the same rules as married or unmarried women in Athens. And they could consort with men, hang out with men, drink with men, and often they were more in more literate circles and listening to things, and the smarter and the more intellectual of them shone kind of brightly in those circles. And it was, but you know, it's not a socially respectable in the wider culture position to be in. You were talking about people being held back if you just kind of ossify a philosopher's views and just take whatever they say and just do whatever you can to defend that. I mean, I think this happened to Aristotle. And it's a sad fact, but I want to recommend a book. It's not by any kind of objectivist author, and I don't agree with all of it, but there's a wonderful story in it. It's called Aristotle's Children. And I'm not plumping for the book, but I've read this book and I think it's wonderful. And it tells a wonderful story too. It's non-scholarly in effect. It's a popular book, but I think it gets the facts right in many cases, and certainly about the main story he's telling, not quite some of his evaluations toward the end, but he tells a story about how Aristotle's writings were lost and then how they were kind of carried out into the what we now know as the Middle East, into Iraq, Baghdad, and so on, and sort of led to the real flowering of Islamic civilization in, what is it, I guess the 10th century, and then how those writings showed up in Muslim Spain and were rediscovered and brought back into the world in the 12th century through the 13th century, and translated and copied, and then it was like discovering time capsule from another world, a future civilization. And because you think about what the time was like, and this goes to the cultural importance of Aristotle. I mean, and one of the reasons why Rand thinks that he's the atlas that holds the world on his back is that when in the Middle Ages, I mean, what did you know, right? You know very little in terms of science. It's all about getting to the other world. It's a veil of tears. You're innately sinful. You obey the church and so on. And you discover all of this material. I mean, they had something like, they had the Categories and De Interpretatione by Aristotle, very small, important works, but you couldn't possibly get a sense of Aristotle from that. And then gradually his metaphysics, his physics, his Nicomachean ethics, his biological works, I mean, all of this wealth of knowledge comes, and the West had to go back to school, in effect, and they had to learn from Aristotle, and it was like a bombshell. And it kind of rocked the Middle Ages. It broke the Middle Ages is what it did, because what it did is they had to come to terms with it. You couldn't ignore it. And what scholars in the arts faculties at these medieval universities, they were reading it. Like, this is fascinating. And what the hell do we do with this? I mean, so there's this guy who seems brilliant. He seems to know a lot of stuff that we don't. And he's obviously a genius. And on the other hand, he doesn't think there's a God. He sort of does. But it's more part of his astronomy than anything else. But there's no other world. There's no afterlife. There's no immortal soul. There's no hell, there's no heaven. And he thinks that your happiness on earth is the goal of ethics. I mean, like, and that the earth is, and that the universe is eternal. It has no creator, no beginning. What do we do with this? You know, and they had this kind of mixed relationship where lots of scholars really wanted to dig in and study and try to get an understanding of this knowledge. Others tried to integrate it with church doctrine to kind of figure, like, how do we meld what we want with what the other part we want, like in religion. And I mean, there were various condemnations by the church of certain theses that are present in Aristotle's work. I know in 1277, the University of Paris banned some of Aristotle's writings as a result of this. And so the University of Toulouse in southern France said, like, we still teach Aristotle. And so scholars would go down to Toulouse and study there. And then they lifted the ban and they kind of went back and forth a bit. And because they really, you can't really reconcile them. I mean, one's a secular pro-man, pro-this life, pro-reason viewpoint. And another one is a mystical, otherworldly attitude of faith and obedience. And they don't go together. I mean, the major synthesis, and Ayn Rand had a lot of respect for Thomas Aquinas in this regard as well, because the major synthesis is to bring Aristotle, is to integrate Aristotle. Well, it made Aristotle respectable for the people who respected the church. So if you look at Thomas Aquinas' actual philosophy, it's basically Aristotle. It's just Aristotle. I mean, he makes some changes, he makes some innovations and so on, but it's basically he just takes on Aristotle's philosophy for the most part. And then he has his religion. But what he did was he drew a distinction between natural theology, you know, the areas where he thinks that these are truths of religion, but these are ones we can prove by reason. And we don't need texts or Bible or faith or any of that. But then there's the areas that are just the mysteries of religion. And those you just have to accept. What are you going to do? They're non-rational. And then, but in when you're doing science and things, you follow reason and you follow Aristotle's method and Aristotle's science. And so what it did is it made it okay to study Aristotle and to take that seriously. But the melding of Aristotle with church doctrine, that sort of ossified a lot of the actual conclusions Aristotle reached. It's like, you don't know, you can't challenge that. You know, the planets or whatever, perfect spheres, and they go in perfect circular orbits because that's what perfect things do. And they hung on to that, you know, and to the point where, I mean, you get these stories of theologians refusing to look through Galileo's telescope. And I don't know if that's anecdotal or whatever, but or apocryphal. But I mean, Aristotle, what they did is they abandoned his method. And this is why Ayn Rand called Aristotle the forgotten man in philosophy. Because where his influence, where people were, the scientists trying to make real progress in the sciences, see Aristotle as their enemy. We got to get rid of all that nonsense from Aristotle, some aspects of his physics or his astronomy to make progress. Well, yeah, there are conclusions in Aristotle's astronomy and in his physics, yeah, that you need to progress beyond, you need to get beyond, you need to abandon them. But they took it as Aristotle's method is deductive. Science is about deduction from axioms and so on, deduction from definitions, and it's completely false. Aristotle as a scientist is heavily inductive. His philosophy is heavily inductive. And he's very critical of people who place theory over observed facts. And there's this wonderful passage from The Generation of Animals, where he's talking about bees and how bees reproduce and so on. And he said something like, and this is how, you know, the generation of bees works if we go by theory and what is believed to be the facts about them. But he says the facts have not been properly and fully ascertained yet. And so we have to make sure we're not going by theory above the observed facts. And so you only go by a theory if it fits the observed facts. But the observed facts on the ground, what you're collecting, the data you're collecting and trying to integrate by a theory, that's your standard for how you assess a theory. It's not you start from some theory and then just work outward to what the world must be like. He was totally against that.
The one problem I always had with Aristotle is, how did he get the wrong number of teeth in women's mouth? Like, why did he count a woman's mouth?
I don't know. There's an article. Yeah, there's an article on this. I mean, Bertrand Russell said, how come he didn't ask Mrs. Aristotle? I don't know what dental hygiene was like in ancient Greece and whether people had a standard number of teeth, but I don't know. I mean, I've seen some pieces written about this. I don't have an answer because I haven't like looked into that in particular.
Yeah, I've actually been working on a few theories of my own, totally just maybe quite silly, but I remember I used to live in Mexico for a while and they had a phrase there that with every time you have birth, you lose a tooth. And I, like many women, I had a child and I did end up losing a tooth, you know. Apparently pregnancy can weaken the teeth a lot. And so this was my idea that maybe women end up losing their teeth a bit more from things like pregnancy and such. And
the philosophic aspect of this, and I think the issue of, as an issue of justice for Aristotle and how to be objective about thinking about Aristotle, is part of it is about being objective. And that is, yeah, okay, so maybe he wasn't completely free of whatever biases or whatever that were permeating his culture or whatever. Okay, so maybe he isn't. And you should say, well, that's part of a bias, if that's what it is. I don't know if that's what it is. Maybe it is. But partly it's also that, I mean, as a matter of justice, I try to avoid the feet of clay issues with your heroes. He is an atlas in that regard, and a philosophic genius at the highest level. And his achievements, and I think it is really true. I mean, Ayn Rand thinks this is true. I certainly do. That where Aristotle's fundamentals, his philosophic fundamentals, dominate, you get a much better culture. And you know, and it's immeasurable. I think he had the positive contributions that he made. And so if maybe he had some biases or he got a whole bunch of stuff wrong, I mean, okay, that's fine. And I think we can, in a very healthy and objective way, acknowledge that, acknowledge what he gets wrong, acknowledge what he gets wrong, but he couldn't know better. And just contextualize the errors without ignoring them. Because when you're concerned with what's true and what's right, errors are errors, mistakes are mistakes, falsehoods are falsehoods, and regardless of who said it, you know, and whether it's Plato or Ayn Rand or Aristotle, if you're really focused on the truth and not dedication to a savior or something, it's no, you say, no, I don't agree with this. I don't think this is right, but I think this is right. This is important and true and good. And that's, I mean, objectivity is it's the standard.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, you don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater. Like just because, you know, Isaac Newton liked alchemy doesn't mean that gravity doesn't exist. You know? I think that's a really good point. I often like to think of like the art of cherry picking, you know, that there is, it sounds, we make it sound bad to cherry pick, to pick one thing out over another, like, but you can go from any culture or book or music or say the things that are good out of it and dismiss the things that are bad. Which
you can also say, well, Hitler was nice to his dog, and so there's some good, and it's like that. That's the wrong kind of. Well, you have to think of things in terms of their level of importance, and what it means, what a cultural figure represents, what are his fundamental ideas, where is he fundamentally wrong versus he got a few minor things right, or there were some minor things good about him, but he's fundamentally evil. I mean, you can't put those on a level. Like they're just cards all spread out on the table and, oh, yeah. Well, this is nothing. No.
The funny racist or something, you know, like, well, like the funny racist. You're like,
oh, yeah. Right. That's a good example.
No, that's an excellent point. I guess this brings me to what you said kind of right in the beginning, that Ayn Rand's philosophy is a development within the Aristotelian tradition. So do you think there are ways in which Rand improves on Aristotle's philosophy?
Yeah. I mean, so just I'll take a few. I mean, there are, I think, a number of important areas, but some are more technical. So maybe I'll just mention some of them, but I'll talk about some more in some detail. In ethics, for example, there are good things in Aristotle's ethics, definitely. I mean, his view that there's an ultimate value that we're trying to aim at, and that it's what the rest is focused toward, and he thinks this is happiness or eudaimonia, as he puts it, some kind of flourishing or well-lived life according to reason. And he offers various kinds of virtues, many of which are sensible. But Rand's view is that, you know, I mean, this is how she interprets him. It's that he's looking at what the noble and wise people of Athens are like, and he's isolating characteristics, which he thinks are very important, and that these are part of the things that exemplify an ideal kind of person or an ideal kind of life, and these are the things that you should try to represent or actualize in your character and in your thinking. But Ayn Rand's view is, in the end, though, he doesn't give a valid justification for these. And he thinks that, I mean, Aristotle says, I don't think ethics is an exact science where you can really demonstrate that this is what you need to do, these things to follow, these are why the virtues are valuable. He takes them all as the virtues as all, in some ways, exemplifications of being rational or excellent as a human being. But there's no justification in the end, I think, for them. And Rand's view is, you need a justification, because what we've been suffering with for so many decades and millennia is you don't have a rationally demonstrated code of ethics where you can demonstrate, no, this is the, these are the principles that you should live by and show that they're true, as opposed to this is what society expects or this is what God demands. And so Rand's innovation there was to identify life as the standard of value. Life is the phenomenon that gives rise to the whole phenomenon of values. If you're just in a world of rocks, rivers, and space dust, and that's all that exists, there's no right and wrong, there's no good and bad, there's no evaluative concepts like that. Who needs them? Nobody needs them. They don't come up. It's only for living organisms that face a fundamental alternative by they continue in existence or they go out of existence. And it's that's what gives the whole set of certain things are polarized. These are the pro-life and these are the anti-life. These are the things that hurt and harm me. These are the things that help and sustain me. And that's what gives the whole the metaphysical basis for the divide between evaluating things as this is good for my life, this is bad for my life. These methods of functioning allow me to live my life and to acquire knowledge and to pursue values. This method of functioning leads me off the track and I'm just obeying what other people are telling me. I'm conforming to other people's opinion and I'm not thinking clearly. So that's the basis for that Rand uses to identify which virtues that you should try to embody in your character and to develop, and what methods of functioning to live by, what values to pursue, what goals to go after, and then how to prioritize them or put them in a hierarchy. And that's, so her view is that she's formulated a scientific, test tubes in labs, but a scientific approach to ethics, where you take a fundamental fact of human nature that gives rise to the whole need of values, and then to start specifying which values do you need if life is your goal. If successful life as a human being on Earth is your goal, there are definite things that you need to abide by, definite methods of functioning, definite kind of virtues you need to embody. And so that's a major innovation on her part. Another point is that I think her main criticism of Aristotle, or main thing that she thought was a problem or a weak point, is in part his view of the highest reaches of reason for Aristotle is the highest exemplification of what it really means to reason is contemplation. And it's kind of knowledge as an end in itself. Now I can understand a thinker of Aristotle's caliber to hold that view. I understand why someone could hold that view. And it's also the times in which he lives, I think limit how practical that kind of highest level of abstract thought is. And Ayn Rand's view is that it's not only true, as Aristotle thinks, that reason is your means of knowledge. Rand's view is reason is your means of survival. But she said, I could not have formulated that viewpoint. And I couldn't have formulated my ethics, which is it's centrally based around that viewpoint, prior to the Industrial Revolution. So she said, you can't blame Aristotle for not grasping that, that's for sure. So I couldn't have done it either. Not before the Industrial Revolution, where what you grasped is, in the ancient world is, suppose Aristotle figures out all this stuff about the heavens and the cosmos and how mollusks breed, and what are you gonna do with that? It's fascinating. You're grasping more knowledge and more understanding of the world, and it's a wonderful thing, but what do you do with that? What's the impact on human life? I don't know. It's interesting.
Yeah, to take philosophy and make it productive is a whole other level of accomplishment, I suppose.
Yeah, and when you think about what the scientific revolution and coming out of it, the Industrial Revolution made possible, it made it very clear that the highest levels of abstract thought, we're talking about theoretical physics and things like the highest levels of abstract thought have enormous practical implications on human life. And what you can do with that knowledge, in terms of going from the super abstract level of the sciences to the engineering and the technological progress, and that you can, human standard of living just skyrockets, you know, and it's like, no, it's not just that the man is capable of the heights of abstract thought, and that's interesting, and it's pleasurable. It's, no, we need to be operating at that level, because this is how we bring, look what we're doing, how we're communicating today. This is sci-fi. right? I mean, none of us could, none of us could, it would take lifetimes and lifetimes and lifetimes and genius that I don't have to develop and understand the rules, the laws of physics and stuff to figure out how we even can communicate. I mean, you're in Argentina, how we can communicate at this kind of distance. And it's, these are the kinds of things that have revolutionized our lives, made them longer, safer, in so many ways. I mean, literally everything in my room, in your room, I mean, is man-made. I mean, literally everything.
Yeah, I'm looking around.
And so her view, and she's probably the only thinker that regards productiveness as a moral virtue. Not that you created 100 widgets this year and 200 widgets next year. It's not about that. It's productiveness is the application of reason to create the values, the material values that human life requires and that it sustains and enriches it. And she regards it as a moral view. And she regards it as a moral view because life is the standard. If life is your goal, productiveness is a virtue.
Now, and of course, this does make it tricky with Rand's philosophy that the very premise is that life is the goal. And obviously that's going to be in direct conflict with the mystical type otherworldly philosophers who believe that it's the afterlife that's the goal. So, I mean, right from the get-go, if you're trying to teach other people about it, you have to give them, they have to believe with that initial premise. Otherwise they're at a stopping point.
To bring this back to Aristotle, I want to bring this back to Aristotle because you mentioned the point about the otherworldly types, right? So you're all about life on Earth, and it's a selfish view in the end. In other words, it's self-focused, it's self-directed. It's the focus of my life is to try to live my life in a certain way that what I can attain is happiness. And happiness not just you just follow in whatever whim you feel like, but it's the concomitant of living according to real human standards for success and for flourishing. And it's the psychological component of that and knowing that you're operating on the right premises. Aristotle, so Ayn Rand gets a lot of flack about advocating selfishness and so on. And there's a wonderful passage. You mentioned you like the sections in the ethics in the Nicomachean Ethics on friendship. And I think they're wonderful passages. But in, what is it? Book 9, chapter 8, I think it is. He talks about self-love. And it's an interesting passage because this is something Ayn Rand had to grapple with as well in the introduction to her book, The Objectivist Ethics. The Virtue of Selfishness. The introduction to that book, she raises this point. It's similar in many ways to what Aristotle says in that passage in the Nicomachean Ethics. He says, he's talking about friendship and he's talking about love of self. And he says, you know what? It's interesting because people often are criticized for being self-lovers, and that's a reproach, right? And he says, but there's something wrong about that. So there's a sense in which it's understandable when somebody think of the self-lover as the person who he tries to grab more and more stuff, he tries to outdo other people, accumulate a bunch of stuff, in a kind of a lower or kind of whatever, so think of as more base kind of level. Like the glutton or whatever, or he doesn't care about other people and anything. And Aristotle's like, well, there is that kind of person, and I think that life is worth reproach. That is a good life. But it all turns on to think about it as that person a self-lover? And it's like, well, that depends on what you think of as the self. And his view is that no, that reason, your intellect, your mind, the faculty which thinks and judges, that's fundamentally yourself, And he says, I think one should be fundamentally a lover of self if that's what you take to be yourself. It's the person who awards himself the best. And no one would say, oh, he's trying too hard to get too much virtue. He's trying too hard to be, too much committed to honesty and integrity and courage. And it's, no, you wouldn't reproach somebody as a self-lover. But he says, I think that's in essence what the essence of self-love is having a proper conception of what yourself is, a proper conception of what is best, and then to go after it with a real idealism and seriousness and get as much of it as you can, so to speak, and honor that part of you that's the best with the best. And so he's grappling with that whole, I mean, again, Ayn Rand is like, people say, selfishness, you're advocating selfishness. And that means just you run out and trample other people, get whatever you want, you know, screw everybody over. And Ayn Rand's like, really? You think that's what's in your self-interest? When you think about, you're trying to live a life, you're trying to attain happiness, you're trying to think long range and plan the kind of methods you would use to conduct your life. That's really, that's what you think is in your, because I don't think that's in your interest at all. You know,
yeah, I think one of my favorite quotes of hers always is when they asked about her loving her partner, going, "Well, I love him selfishly," you know, and when she responds, "Well, how would it make you feel if you say you love somebody for their sake only?" You know, that.
Yeah, you know, I get no selfish enjoyment out of hanging out with you or being with you or spending time with you, but I did it for your benefit, not mine.
Yeah. That should be your next Valentine's card, right?
It would be a deep insult.
Yeah.
And her view is, I mean, loving is, again, the reason why she keeps using this term selfishness is she's trying to crack, to break an association that we have in our culture for a long, long time of the pursuit of one's own interests with evil. That's what's been fused. And she says she calls it a package deal. You know, you've got to snap that association. There are people who pursue, I mean, because then you lump somebody like Bernie Madoff, who's a big time swindler, with somebody like Steve Jobs. I mean, these are just kind of archetypes. They're not, I don't know what these people like as people. Well, it seems like one's getting stuff for himself and the other guy's getting stuff for himself. And you don't differentiate in fundamental terms. One is a productive genius. Who creates things and trades them on a free market with other people who are interested and willing to buy it, and an innovator, and one is a crook who defrauds people out of their money to get stuff for himself. And you can't think of both of these things. If you think of both of these as in the same folder, like you'd put these two people in the same HR folder, you can't really work with that as a folder. And you think about a folder as a kind of a metaphor for a concept. If you think about the selfish person, you put both of those in the same group, you can't think clearly.
Well, all you're doing is you're just saying that they're both wealthy. I mean, how they obtain that wealth would truly be indicative of more of their ethical.
Yeah. The producer and the thug don't belong in the same category, even if they both think of themselves as going after stuff for themselves. So, I mean, Ayn Rand has a lot to say about that. There's a lot of work to unpack and talk about and discuss, so we can't do here. But it's interesting that passage from the Ethics. Aristotle is wrestling with that, a similar idea.
I think we're probably starting to run out of time, so I think just to finish up, maybe you can tell our listeners what you're working on at the moment.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, I'm doing a lot of ongoing stuff, so I teach a distance learning program in philosophy, particularly in objectivism, but also other philosophic systems, for the institute called the Objectivist Academic Center. So that's kind of an ongoing thing that basically maps onto a college school year, where people can log in from around the world. So I teach that every year. That's just sort of an ongoing thing. In terms of projects right now that I'm working on, I'm working on an article on free will. And this is coming out in part from the article you mentioned that you guys published on Classical Wisdom Weekly, The False Promise of Stoicism. And one of the things that's interesting, I got a lot of flack for that article. It's funny because one wing of the sort of modern Stoic community was kind of held the view that you're calling out Stoicism for its determinism, you know, the idea that you don't have free will. And they're like, no, Stoicism doesn't say that. You have free will and they're not determinists, and so you're arguing at a straw man. And then the other wing of the Stoic community is like, absolutely, they're determinists. Of course, Stoics are determinists, but you're wrong to attack determinism because determinism is true. And I think that's an interesting phenomenon, but the way in which modern Stoicism has had to deal with or reconcile or abandon certain aspects of the Stoic perspective. And there's something fundamental underneath that I want to talk about. And I think there are reasons why people today, particularly people in the sciences or in philosophy, think of, if you advocate free will, as Ayn Rand does, if you advocate free will, that you're advocating something mystical. you're advocating something non-causal in some way, something just sort of happens. And I think they've been, I think there's a view of causality involved there, which I think is mistaken, and which is causing that sort of phenomena. To reject free will as non-causal, or to reject free will as it's something sort of mystical. And Rand's view is there, you have free will, but it's not at all mystical. It's fully natural capacity that human beings have. And the issue is to explain it. So I'll be doing, I'm working on an article that addresses that sort of issue.
Well, I definitely look forward to reading it, and hopefully we can publish it again in Classical Wisdom and continue the conversation, because as I started this off with, I always love getting everybody to talk about these things and question Aristotle and Rand, and to think about them more seriously. And I think in our day-to-day lives, they're actually improved upon quite immensely by just even the act of thinking about this way to interpret the world and how we should live in it, whether it is, you know, purely by reason or otherworldliness. I think the investigation of those two dualities is important as well. So I'll put links as well to your articles as well as to your online learning course. And I just want to say thank you again for taking the time to talk to me. And I hope everyone learned a little bit more about both Aristotle and Ayn Rand.
Great. Well, it was totally my pleasure.